Welcome to Nectures Conversation Journeys. We travel to or invite the movers and shakers of the mobility, energy, and climate ecosystem. Listen in and enjoy the talks.
We're ready to start for another episode of the Nectures Conversations Journey. And I have the pleasure today to welcome Anders. Anders Wall, a seasoned executive leader, lastly at Green Mobility, but involved in the Shared Mobility ecosystem for years and years. And I'm super, super proud to have you here with us today. I'm specifically interested to learn about yourself, of course, a little bit your history, but also over the years, the kind of touch points you had with that industry. And we can take it from there. But welcome, first of all.
Thank you very much, Christian. Pleasure to be here and have this conversation with you about a truly remarkable industry that we're both part of. And one that has seen so many developments in the last 5-10 years. And I think more than if you go longer back in the sort of automotive and transportation, then we've really seen so much happening in the last few years. And it makes me very exciting for the future and the results.
It's pretty crazy. But when we were founded 10 years ago, and we were not focusing on car sharing fleets per se as our core market. We actually were focused on delivering parking information. So, but what we did is, because car sharing vehicles were the first vehicles in the market that were fully connected, we used existing public data on car sharing movements to give us to use that as proxy data for parking behavior, right? So at that point in time, that's just 10 years ago, but that seems like ages ago,
right?
It is. When the first APIs and the players that were, let's say, not dominating, but the big names in the industry at that point in time are not the big names nowadays, right? That's completely changed. So what are the big shifts that you've recognized in your time that you spent in that industry?
I think for me, a big change, a big pivotal change has been, of course, the introduction of EVs. When we started Green Mobility, we looked towards the industry. We had a few players back then. We had DriveNow and Car2Go before the merger, and those were the predominant players. But most of the fleets were on traditional ICE cars. And we believed firmly that in the future, which this is back in 2016, in the future, future that would hold EVs as a predominant type of cars for cities, but also, I think more importantly, it would become a requirement from cities. So we took, I think, to some extent, a gamble. We started the company with entirely EV fleet. And at that time, having only EVs was, it's fun to look back at, but a lot of people were afraid of driving EVs.
Yes.
And today it's a common thing everywhere.
Yeah.
So that has definitely been a huge change that now it's just, we drive an EV. That's not an issue anymore. But it was not too long ago in the same with you guys when you started. So that has been a remarkable change. And it's sort of prompted a lot of change in thinking from our customers, but also people in general. This notion of going from refueling cars to charging it, and how do I think differently? How do I plan and anticipate that? So I would say for sure EV has been a huge change in the world.
Mm-hmm. How did you solve the issues that you come across? I mean, at that point in time, let's talk 2016, it means infrastructure, like very rudimentary, right?
Yeah.
How do you run then a fleet of several hundred cars, like peak fuel EVs? How do you have to do that?
It was the challenge of the day, absolutely. Fast chargers were non-existing. I mean, it was really what we've called slow charging or 11 kilowatt charging. And I think we were, to some extent, we were lucky, and that also motivated our move into EVs. That at that time, Copenhagen or Denmark was essentially a trial market for E.ON, the large German power company. So we had, relative to the number of EVs in the city, we had a surplus of chargers.
Oh, wow.
So it made it, and at the same time, more or less no one, private consumers
used those chargers, right?
So we had an abundant, not an abundant, we had enough, let's put it that way. Mm-hmm. The challenge was whenever I started building up the company international markets, traveled around Europe, meeting with cities and went to cities, and they told me, well, we have two chargers. Mm. Okay, that's not going to work. So how are we going to do that?
Yeah.
We had to also engage in dialogue with power company electricians, the city. Were they interested in investing in this, and how do we scale this up? Mm. So it was definitely a challenge in the first couple of years, and we had to focus entirely on cities where we had some level of charging infrastructure.
Mm-hmm. How would you see or how did you experience the role that cities took in that game? Because I think, I mean, they're definitely not the same, right? There are cities that live with this attitude and this attitude. But what did you see there? And what, also looking a little bit into the future, what would you encourage cities to take, or what role would you encourage them to take to be an active player in the ecosystem? Because they are on a critical path. You can't do it without them, right?
I agree.
But if they're pure passive, then they might miss out on some very important things. So what's your take on that?
Absolutely agree. There's a huge difference. And I've seen, I would say, all types of cities' thoughts and processes on it. I think when we started, it was more a sort of a nice to have when we, because our approach was, of course, we are helping the environment in your city. Are we replacing private cars, less pollution, all that? And in some cities, like, yeah, that's nice, but this was on a longer scale and it was not really need to have, right?
Yes.
That changed, especially changed during COVID.
Mm-hmm.
Then all of a sudden, everyone wanted to change because we saw these images of car-free cities and all that. So looking at some of the cities I went and met with, some of them were, yeah, you can set up business, we don't care, you go do whatever you want. And others were truly engaging. I remember especially a meeting I had with the city of Amsterdam.
Mm-hmm.
And we always inquired about parking and charging, of course. And at that time, and I think it's still the case, Amsterdam had the best charging network operated by the city, by the way, in all of Europe. And I remember asking them, well, what if there's an area where there's no charges? They laughed a little bit at me because, of course, that was not the case. But if I found an area where we needed charging,
yes,
I should simply call them. And within a few months, they would have put off charges.
Oh, wow.
And when you meet a city like that, think, okay, we want to go here and we want to do business here.
Yes.
And then you can imagine the opposite, where there's absolutely no support or interest. And I think the interest is the key part. And the city is they're very much a part of this. And you still see cities that are prone to the traditional way of having mobility, trains, buses, and pretty much it, and then private cars. But you have to have an open mind. You have to be proactively, as a city as well, seeing, okay, do we have charging infrastructure? That's a fundamental. But also look at parking structures. How do we help this change? Because almost all cities want to have this change. They want to get rid of polluting private cars, reduce traffic, make it much more sustainable. Okay, so then you have to start doing something. It's not going to magically appear by itself.
Yes.
And the city has a huge part to play in that.
Yeah, I've also seen, how to put it, the cities that we now operate in, the cities that were extremely progressive on electrification, like Hamburg. Mm-hmm. Yes, we now operate the largest EV fleets and quite successfully so. And that means that hundreds or even thousands of vehicles are non-ICE cars, right? Nowadays, in comparison to other cities. So I think that also allowed the city to set some of the rules, but like being supportive on the one hand side and taking that as an, let's say, an opportunity or even as an obligation to set clear rules about how things should work out in this very specific city.
I think it's a very much about sort of stick and carrot. We see a lot of cities that are just banning polluting cars or taking away parking spots and all that, and then assuming that everyone will change to the public transportation. And it's not working.
Yeah.
You have to say, okay, we're going to take away this, but we're going to substitute it for this, or we're going to give these types of mobility some kind of preference. It can be parking, charging, cost-wise, and otherwise, to promote the use of that. Because ultimately, it is the citizens and the users who have to think this is easier than I have to if I take my private car.
Yes.
I think sometimes the cities, or maybe many times the cities lose track of that. They focus very much, okay, what's convenient for the city.
Yeah.
And you have to think about, okay, all, not only the, if you, it's a capital city, not only the inhabitants in the capital, but all the suburbs and areas, how can we make it easy for them?
Yes.
Because that will ultimately benefit the economics of that city.
Mm-hmm. How did you deal with, and it's a question that came to my mind because you were tackling using, quote, not just public transport, unquote, right? So I quite often hear the assumption that public transport is in kind of competition with shared mobility and car sharing, right? How do you see that playing in the real world?
It's funny that you mention that because we, so many cities, we I got told that, no, but you're competing with our public transport. Mm. And I never really fully understood it because for one, I mean, even if we have 2,000 cars in a city, we can never fully compete with a train service.
Yeah.
It will move much more people at a much lower cost than we could ever do.
Mm-hmm.
Are we taking a few away? Maybe so. But what we actually learned was that in cities where you had well-functioning public transport, those were the cities where car sharing worked the best.
Exactly. And it's the same experience that I have.
Yeah.
It's like complementary, right?
Absolutely.
And it kind of, it's like a symbiosis. Yeah.
Completely.
They foster each other at the end of the day.
And ultimately, they help support motivation to keep driving polluting cars out because now you have so many options. Mm-hmm. So why should I bring in my car?
Yeah.
Whereas the other place, the other cities where you have poor public transport, everyone owns a car. They need to. So I agreed they complement each other completely. Mm-hmm. And you can say, okay, but then you're following the same lines. No, because reality is that we all move in different direction. Short story, we had a partnership with the Vue, the public transport company in Oslo.
Yeah.
And they are state-owned. And after a while operating green mobility share cars, they actually got some negative press because why should a state-owned company use resources to support a privately owned company and take away exactly that that spots in public transport? Mm-hmm. So they did a lot of research with their own data and the data from the car sharing service. And we're actually able to prove that if I simplified, okay, bus and trains went this way and car sharing went this way. So all the cars never took the same routes. It was actually complementary because they supported a need for a different type of route.
Yes.
Different usage. And that was actually a landmark report as well.
Yeah.
Because that really supported of how these things, different types of mobility, how they actually support each other and reinforce the movement in cities.
Thank you for sharing that because I wasn't aware of that. And the data obviously proves the case. And I'm a big, big advocate of the complementary approach between public and shared, especially as shared typically fills those gaps that the strong backbone of a public transport just, they can't fill everything, right? It's also about efficiency. Yes, of course, with an endless amount of resources in terms of money, yeah, you can send buses and trams to every last bit of the city, but it's not efficient at all, right? So it's the complementary set.
That's the thing a lot of people in our cities forget.
Mm-hmm.
And they tend to say, oh, well, we have the train runs every 3 minutes. Yeah, but sometimes I need to go the other way or cross that in there. And don't be afraid of having those complementary services.
Mm.
I think we should tie them even closer together. And it's something we've tried several times saying, okay, if you have a monthly card to the public transport, how can we add in X minutes or euros or whatever usage of car sharing service? So they're naturally linked.
Yes.
But I think most places where I've tried, we tried it in Oslo as well. It's almost like an old world meets a new world in mobility and they can't really, it should be very simple from a technological perspective, but then you meet sort of habits in organizations and it takes a while.
Absolutely. So I think like from a regulatory or even political side, and I'm not going into politics in general, but the fostering private public partnerships in that arena, I think is something that would be really accelerating. And the cities that take a proactive stance on that and don't wait for regulatory bodies to tell them what to do, I think they have the most progressive systems in place, right? Yeah. And the most colorful system in place, which then serves the needs of those different kind of people and usage patterns that exist in an ecosystem of a large city at the end of the day.
But we have if we don't, if we're not able to have these collaborations, then we're not going to change, or at least not fast enough. And I don't see any point in private competing with public, because there will be no winner. But there's a lot of, I think, having experienced it on the public side, fear that we are going to change something, we're going to tear something down. But hopefully, or imagine that if we together reach something that was even better.
Yes.
And that's absolutely feasible.
Yes.
And it's very likely, I would say. Because then you focus much more on what is actually needed from the customer. And then imagine if you could rebalance the fleet to better suit the public transportation, something else. So we have to start these communications, but it starts somewhere. I've had several conversations over the years with train operators, public train shop operators. And one thing I found to be the case in most places, when you go outside, especially sort of main train stations, you always have taxi stands.
Yes.
They have priority parking in front.
Yes.
And I've always tried to argue, can't you just put aside an area for shared cars? So there will always be some.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a political warp. Not that I want to pick a fight with the taxi companies per se, but you have to have them this close to each other for it to really work.
Yes.
I have these hubs.
Yes. Yes, I hear you. And I had the same experience with regards to airports. Because we now serve a lot of European airports, managing the supply, the, let's say, optimum supply of vehicles, of shared vehicles at the right point in time and day of the week, blah, blah, blah. So, because that's quite a peaky business, right? If you don't know it. And what's happening there is, yes, the same thing. Right? It's this taxi queue. And then you have to walk for, I don't know, we were in Madrid and it took us literally 20 minutes to find the place where the shared cars were parked.
That's too long.
Was not yet. It's way too long. But I hear you. And there's one counterexample, and that is North America. Funny enough, Vancouver, Avon, I think in North America in general, cities see themselves in a little bit of a different role than in Europe. And what I experienced there is a super fruitful coexistence, symbiosis of the public transport system and the able car sharing system, where every person, every citizen in Vancouver would say, "Yeah, what's the best way to get from the airport to the city? Yeah, you take an able."
Yeah.
And there's a space outside reserved for the ables, and their supply is always there, and you can rely on it. So reliability is super important, right? Of the thing, and there it's already lived in a way that I can also see it happening in some of the European cities. So,
but Vancouver and Evo they've been doing, I mean, both the city but also Evo, they've been doing really well, and I agree they're a very good example of it. I've always looked for as well, whenever we go to a new city, okay, if there's an airport, we have to connect it.
Yeah,
and you would think that's easy, but as you experience in Madrid, it's not always that easy. Well, for one, to actually get the parking spots and then have them at a reasonable distance. Over the years, we've been very fortunate to have it in Copenhagen. It's literally outside the terminal building, the same distance as a taxi. So it's super convenient.
Nice.
Then it's used. But other cities, you have to walk. They will place you far away because we don't know really what to do with these guys.
Mm.
Mm. We're actually complementing your service to make it very easy for travelers exiting the plane to the airport.
Yes, 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 I hear you. I would like to take an angle on or take a look at the unit economic side of running EVs.
Yep.
Because we were serving fleets which are pure ICE, pure EV, and mixed. And especially with the mixed ones, we see the unit economics of those fleets. And it's like, until now, an ICE car at scale is financially more attractive. Is that so? What's your take?
Yeah, yes and no. I think from a service perspective, I don't see it. But from a usage perspective, yes. There is, and some has to do with this sort of familiarity of using EVs. There are still people who are not super comfortable using EVs because range anxiety and all that. Plus you see it, the customers who wants to go for a long trip. okay, it's much easier to refill the card than I have to uncharge, even though charging cards and all this provided. So it has an impact on revenue side. Mm-hmm. You know? But what we've seen, and in the beginning was definitely a chance. It was much more expensive to run EVs than traditional cars.
Yeah.
But what we found is that the service part is less because there's no oil change. There's the engine, well, it's an electric engine, so it runs differently. So my view, it has some advantages as well.
Mm-hmm.
And over the years, we've seen clear improvement on cost size, unit economics. In the beginning, it was just through the roof. Plus, I think we were also on a learning curve. Everyone was.
Yeah, totally.
How do we, you start off by saying, okay, will an EV be worth it? How do we finance it? It's going to be expensive because probably in 3 years' time, the battery will be dead and there's no secondary market. So the main cost item, the asset is challenged.
Mm-hmm.
Reality has proven the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't seen any cars worth the battery with view stop.
Same expense.
Yeah. And I think I've had more than 3,000 EVs through my hands. We had one with a battery malfunction, which was handled by guarantee, 1 out of 3,000. That's
an issue.
Yeah, it's not an issue. So battery was never an issue. So it was really much more about learning how to service the individual parts and how to start measuring in. Because in the beginning, you try to sort of do a little bit on Excel sheets and all that, it's just get this fleet running. It was about building up revenue, getting the brand known, getting customers in, and
The big blocks, right?
Absolutely.
It's really big blocks. And then
you have to start focus and you have to start looking at, okay, how is the economics build up? What are the main costs and which are the costs that we can actually impact? Servicing, of course, but how do we service a car? And when you have a reasonable size of fleet, then all small elements play a part. And you could say, oh, well, that's minute. Yeah, but when you have 1 million trips a year or more, 1,500 cars or more, then it all counts.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to really go down in minute details. And
yeah,
think, okay, when we have to go and service a car, so bring them in for charging, how do we actually dispatch our service crew to be as optimized as possible?
Mm-hmm.
Because if you have 5 people traveling around, it's just too much salary.
Traveling salesman problem, right?
Yes, no,
it's at scale. And then suddenly you have like hundreds of vehicles to charge. Yeah.
Same when it goes to repairs, damages. How do you do that? How do you optimize it? And there's a lot of innovative thinking as well. And it's just looking at it from a different perspective. Can we source this? Can we actually repair the cars in a better way? We ultimately chose to insource repair. So we had
single purchases that took the same decision.
Yeah, and it was a simple calculation at the end of the day, but it took us a while to really realize that.
Mm-hmm.
So whenever we had a car with whatever damage, I had to send 2 guys to the Renault dealership, which by the way was outside our operational zone, and then they came back. So a few hours on that, and the car would sit there for 3, 4, 5 days, and then we had to do the same again.
Massive revenue loss.
No, it was a nightmare. Mm-hmm. And when you start calculating that and you learn how much it impacts the business, then you have to do something else. And we actually brought it down to get an example with a bumper or some of the things that are usually drawn. So we had at all times, I think, 5 to 10 white bumpers on stock, and we could do it within half an hour.
Yes.
But the car is back on the street and it makes revenue.
Yes.
And you have to go through that, I think, for all components of your car, really, how can we do this in a different way? Because the traditional way of servicing and operating an EV fleet, it's just going to cost too much.
And if I may pick this up, because when I made this question or statement of like EVs, like more expensive to run, right? And maybe not unit economic being not as good. I think what we're taking a look at is economies of scale being at a different level of maturity. And I think this is what we're taking a look at, because when I was listening to reading the news article about Hertz inflating, I think, what was it? 20,000 Teslas first, and then having to take the decision to defleet them.
Yeah.
because nobody really thought about how to charge. And then one of the reasons given why they would do this was like this, the unit economics wouldn't work out for EVs. And like, no, it's not true. It's like, yes, if you just start doing this, right? If you do it in a very rudimentary way, but if you take those learning curve steps, you have to build it up. And then at a certain point, yes, you get competitive.
Yes. And I think what I've seen, there's been this sort of notion that changing into EV should from day one just be a success case.
Yeah.
And I think we will see the same when we get more autonomous cars, that we have this built-in expectations that overnight is just going to change everything. But a company like Hertz, they build up their ICE fleet over many years. They had a lot of learning.
Decades.
Where they lost a lot on different parts.
Absolutely.
So when taking in a bunch of Teslas, there's bound to be a learning curve as well. And you have to, instead of just deflating, okay, right, the market is still there. It is. Mm. How do we solve these issues? How do we solve them? They're all solvable, but you have to view it differently. And I think that's also, in some cases, a mindset. Well, we're used to doing this. That doesn't work for an EV. We can't use it. No, you have to work differently.
Yes.
View it differently. And charging, of course, is one, but also repairs and running of the cars.
Yes. And now a little bit shameless self-promotion. That's exactly what we do at the end of the day. Because yes, you can take the time to learn and take those cycles, or you could work with a company who's doing that and did that already a couple of times and can bring you the results and value in a very short period of time, right? So that's always the question, and what is the right timing for that?
Oh, but it's the key. I mean, you now you've built up this data, so you can actually fast track.
Yeah.
Clients, you can fast track fleets on that, because the information, the learning has been done. It wasn't there in the beginning, but of course now it's there, and you can benefit from it.
Mm. What I found interesting when it comes to that, so what we discussed now, And the solving the first challenges of running EV fleets at scale, right? I had a couple of touch points now with those AV fleets, autonomous vehicle fleets in specifically US. And I've been talking to the people running those fleets and operating them. And it's very, very interesting, because they're approaching solving the same problems that you, for example, already solved like 5, 6, 7 years ago. And it's like, oh, wait a minute. I mean, we did that, right? And we had a solution there. You don't necessarily have to redo it from scratch. And it's very interesting, because the fundamental challenges are very, very similar. It's essentially, yes, it's an asset. Yes, it can drive itself. Okay, good. But otherwise, when do we charge? Where do we charge? What's the most efficient distribution for that, doing that, right? Including all the maintenance processes and going hand in hand. It's the same kind of problem we tackle.
And I had actually a chat as well with some of the guys, I think unrelated, but I was also a bit surprised, because I thought, or would have expected at least, that they had sort of built on the learnings. They brought in someone, or at least went and had a look at it and say, okay, that we can use, we can add on to that. Because I think there's a very clear link between those two.
Mm.
But the main difference, of course, is the self-drive. But that's, to me, that's a different part of the business case. You still have to service the car. It has to charge. It has to do all these things.
Yes.
Let's look at what has been done already. Because there's a lot of data and information on that.
Yes. And there's a huge similarity between the two, because you need that meta level of efficiency creation that you do through platforms and process landscapes and leadership building this, right? And this is pretty much the same, because at the end of the day, whether the car is self-driving or not, is just one piece of the entire puzzle, right? And maybe not even the most important one.
Yeah. No, because what I've seen is that you have to, if you don't run your fleets effectively, you're going to lose. You're never going to be profitable.
Mm.
And to me, it doesn't matter whether it's self-driving or not. It will carry some additional benefits, also new challenges in autonomous. But if you don't manage the fleet and you work these challenges and try to reduce costs or optimize them in whatever way is possible, you're going to lose. I've seen other operators in the market with cost elements that were double of ours, would for no apparent reason, otherwise, other than they just didn't work the robot.
Yes.
And that was a truly an eye-opener. I was like, okay, we are doing really, really great. And you have to do that. It's just core business. Figure out where can we actually find minute benefits and changes.
Absolutely. And you know what you just said? You need to work the problem, and you need to work the problem one after the other. Yes. And I see the companies who are doing this, and if and it's their self-understanding that it's that this is their job. They are actually, yes, creating positive unit economics, and yes, they're creating profitability, and yes, it's putting them on a growth path. And now maybe in the macroeconomic scale, even more than before, because there's this new kind of sentiment of, okay, at some point this might all merge, like AVs plus shared plus hailing might be one bubble, right? And we just recently discussed it in our board where an investor was very, how to put it, progressive or extreme in that view. What's your take on that? Is sharing and hailing and AVs just merging into some
fish? I certainly hope so. and I fully believe that it is. They will.
Yeah.
So when we, I think almost from day one, we looked at our business, car sharing, electric car sharing, as a first step towards autonomous vehicles.
Yes.
Interesting. And back in 16, 17, 18, everyone was euphoric in the industry. And we all believed that autonomous was like just tomorrow coming. And then we had flying pods in a few years. And it moves a little bit slower.
Yeah.
But, which is probably a good thing after all. But when you have an autonomous fleet, if we look at it from that perspective, and as we were just talking about, you still need to service it.
Mm.
You need to have a call center.
Yes.
Where you can, for whatever reason, you need someone to talk to. It will have punctures. It will need cleaning and so on.
Yes.
So in car sharing, you've built all these services. We have that model and it works. So combining autonomous with car sharing is to be the obvious. We build our business for wheels. We're just waiting for it to actually materialize. Plus, you have a lot of data already in the business. So you know much, you have a much better view on where do we need to position these cars.
Yes.
So I see autonomous as a way to add much more traction in shared cars or shared mobility to enhance the companies, but also to significantly enhance the usage. Because we are now solving some of the biggest issues for car sharers. That's availability. That whenever, if I need a car right now, maybe there's not one close by. Okay, I'll have to do something else.
Exactly.
But if I can call one, or I say, okay, we are done in 5 minutes, okay, one will be there. Because it can reposition itself.
Yeah.
Over the years, I've done countless of calculations, and we try to see, okay, how can we move the fleet? And we've had so many examples of then we send someone, we both did it ourselves. That's too expensive. Salary-wise, it makes no sense. Then we've done various forms of incentivizing customers, saying if you take a car in this area and move it to this area, we will give you the trip for free or something else. We've seen countless examples of then when the car goes from A to B, a new customer takes it and moves it back to where it was starting. So we've lost because we've given one trip away and then revenue from one user, it's zero sum. But with autonomous, it changes the game entirely. Because now, based on data, the fleet will, for one, reposition itself, or we can actively reposition it depending on specific needs and so on. So it's a given. It has to converge. And I don't see why not. Plus, the idea that we will own autonomous cars is a little far-fetched to me. And why should I own an autonomous car? Maybe they will build some supermodels and whatever, and a few people will
have. There's a need for that, right?
No. But there will probably be a few. But the majority will be in a free-flow scenario. Because why should I have a car at home that I'm not using when I know that in a very short amount of time, a car will come and pick me up and
exactly wish me off to it. Exactly. And that's a pure reliability question, right? If I know a car is going to be there in 5 minutes, I don't care.
You don't care, right?
I mean, or not.
No, you don't need to.
For most use cases, let's put it like that, right?
There will be edge cases, of course. There will be customers with specific needs, and then we'll start looking at how do we service them.
Absolutely.
But the majority of trips made in a city, you can fully support those in And I think it's more a matter of let's move towards that. Let's accelerate that process.
Yes. Yeah.
Because it's, I think also it will help take away this parking issue that so many cities are worried about or local residents are complaining about.
We know from data and we know it from running our fleets that the number of vehicles you need to serve the same amount of mobility, you can reduce it to an absolutely minimum. Yep. You don't need all those cars, right? You don't need them.
That car will drive itself all the time.
Absolutely, which has always been the case for car sharing, right? I mean, yes, we're very aware of that, yeah. Interesting. What I think what it also will enable is the unserved rural areas that are like just at the outbrink of cities and that are underserved typically, right? Because public transport is not going there. Like taxis are way too expensive. So with AVs, you can start to serve those, right? Elderly people, which the European society is getting older and older, need mobility options. I think this is going to be a great contributor to that.
I've done a few of these projects. In Green Mobility, we acquired a small German car sharing, mm-hmm. which predominantly worked in rural areas, and to see how could we get car sharing to work in that type of cities.
Mm-hmm.
It was a challenge, and it will remain a challenge until they get AVs. Recently, I was helping a project in Denmark where they were looking at, could we replace buses in more rural areas with mm-hmm. car sharing? And from a car sharing perspective, it's a bad business,
yes.
because number of trips would be terrible.
Yes.
But approaching that city or region saying, look, instead of running this hugely expensive bus where you have maybe two occupants in, you subsidize a car sharing service for that area. There's a lot of politics in that and that's not easy to change. But if you then add autonomous to that, then
it's a no-brainer, absolutely, right? If you have a self-rebalancing asset that is purely on demand, you never have the occupancy problem. You never, it's like, it's just there where you
need it. The challenge for the current models is that when we go too far out, we know, okay, either the car will be stuck or it will do one or two trips per day, which is not sustaining the business.
Yes.
And over the years, across all the cities we operate in, we always got requests, when are you coming to this area? When are you coming to this area? And of course, it gave us some insight.
Yeah,
for market development, but it was also, we want to do it, but there's not enough, so there's not going to be a good business. Now you can push much further. I'm just looking forward to it, that I don't have to worry about it anymore.
Oh my God, yes.
But still have a few roadblocks to clear before we get there. But for me, it will be the next game changer. We saw sort of the inflow of EV, how that's changed a lot, mainly on sustainability part. Now, once we get to autonomous, it will be an even bigger game changer.
Yes. And the funny part is AVs are by definition EVs only. That is 100% electrification rates. Dude, it's just what it is. One thing that
then you can't, there's no argument.
No,
all these arguments. Oh, I still want to have an,
yes, I want to know.
No,
it's gone, done.
And it's by default EV, I agree. And I think default also not privately owned. Mm. It would be fleet operator.
I agree. So Lyft recently acquired Free Now, right? And there was speculation why we do this, et cetera. I mean, my take, and please feel free to disagree, was they acquired the user base. They acquired access to European consumers, right? As a US company, thinking about move into Europe, that's where you want to start. If you have to build it up from scratch, yeah, it's going to be very expensive. So that means that from a car share perspective, your existing car share, your user base is definitely an asset, right? What do you see to be the other assets in that case? And just maybe let me do one speculation, because you said before, the operational backbone that you create as a car sharer is exactly what you need then also to run an AV fleet on top of it, right?
Yeah.
That doesn't change. So is that the second big asset of a car sharing company right now?
I mean, it's hard to disagree with the customer base. Any new market, I mean, if you could some way get a huge customer base quickly, then the city would grow much faster.
Yes.
Very simple, demand and supply. But I think what I've learned for sure is that the operational backbone and knowing how to do things became a much bigger asset than we thought.
Mm-hmm.
When we started, we had sort of internal jokes saying we had to do everything. We had to reinvent everything.
Mm-hmm.
But it was actually true mm-hmm. because there were no one we could go out and employ who could bring in mm-hmm. experience. You had traditional car rental,
mm-hmm.
but it's a different business model. You do it differently.
Yes.
So they couldn't bring the experience we needed. So we had to sort of learn a lot on our own.
Mm-hmm.
Did a lot of mistakes. That's part of when you build up company.
Yeah.
But the model of operating that backbone was truly what gave us the value.
Mm-hmm. And in running the business, right, from a shareholder and investor point of view, this might be something like, oh my God, you really have to go into this. Like, you really have to do this. It's a problem, right? It's a problem. From a strategic perspective, nowadays, it might be even seen as an asset. That's what I find kind of funny, right?
They look at, okay, who actually knows how to operate this?
Yeah.
And I've seen several who are not able to operate it. They are focused either on a brand, mm-hmm. on a platform that they develop, or something else. And all of them can have their respective value.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's this notion you can't do everything well. And I think we focused very much on operating the fleet day to day, 24/7, mm-hmm. year round. How can we do this in the best possible way? We did not have the most sexiest car. And that was also, okay, should we go other ways, go other avenues? But at the end of the day, back to the unit economics and where you can reach profitability is by having essentially a lean operational model mm-hmm. and knowing exactly what to do, when to do it, and how to predict also what's going to happen. That's where you will find value over the long term. And once you have it, you can scale it much faster because you know what to do and adapt global markets, but it's very clear.
Yeah.
I think that was an, and then I think, and in that lies as well, the ability of making some good partnerships. So for example, insurance is a big mm. issue. Damages, how do you work with that? How to keep it low?
Mm.
Except there will be some, but working with that. And I think the last part, which is also taking interesting turn in the moment, the real asset in terms of the car, the EV, who owns it and who actually operates it?
Yes.
And I just read, I think it was yesterday, that a big part of Waymo's fleet will be actually owned and operated by Move in the US.
That's correct.
And and they are taking a different, they want to be asset light, and a lot of companies want to be asset light. Move went the other way and say, okay, we specialize in owning that asset.
And operating, owning it. Yeah, operating it, because we're really, really good at that, yeah.
That's one part of the value chain.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we will see more of those having a part of it, because spanning everything, there's too big a risk in it.
Yeah, absolutely. And when it comes to the, let's say, running operational backbones at scale and at the super high level of efficiency, this by definition will have to be a multi-operator model. Like multi-brand kind of a framework utilizing that super efficiency kind of backbone at the end of the day, because it doesn't matter, because yes, you of course, why wouldn't you use the same charging infrastructure if that's the most efficient thing to do, right? And you then start to market segment or do market segmentation more on the branding side, basically, or around use cases than necessarily based on the operational model. Because
that's also a change, I would say, we've seen over the past years. When we started, you had COVID changed a lot, but pre-COVID, we had a lot of car sharing operators in Europe, and everyone wanted to sort of control everything in their company. And you had very little collaboration, right? And because, yeah, we don't want to share with you, and you to sort of build up market, and everything just went one way. Now we've seen business models that have changed, like the one you just mentioned, and I think we'll see more, because doing all of it has led to too many failures. It is too costly.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. I could go on forever, Anders. It's been really, really a pleasure talking to you. I got one question at the end of each of our conversations that I had asked my interview partners. And that is a little bit of a game, because I would put us into a time capsule and zoom us into the year 2035, so 10 years from now. From the position of 2035, if you take a look at the two of us sitting here, like in this year 2025, what advice would you give us?
I would probably sum it up to move faster and push the limits, because we've, in my mind, we've fallen behind in Europe when we compare to US, especially in China. Mm-hmm. China, we lost a lot in innovation on mobility. We can see the automotive landscape in Europe is they're really struggling. But also on city level, we are holding back. Cities are reluctant to allowing tests for autonomous cars. But in Shanghai, everyone can go take them, and you go to San Francisco. Okay, so why can't we do it in Europe?
Yes,
of course we can do it. We have a too rigid system, and that needs to change. And they're not going to do it. We as an industry, we have to push. We have to move faster than that. We have to. If we don't get to autonomous and hopefully have some European companies in that game as well, we're going to lose even bigger.
Yeah, and someone else will do it for us. And that's
the guarantee.
Others are not waiting for anything. No, it's then someone else will do it for us.
And the question is if the game has been lost already.
Yes, yes.
And I hope not.
Nah, I truly believe in terms of confidence that it's not about owning everything. It's also a very European concept, by the way. but what role can we be unique in and specialized at the manner that we're just doing it? We're just the best in doing it, right? And being part of that ecosystem. I think ultimately mobility is going to be very much a global game. And there will be global players.
And we have to have that outlook aspiration.
Yeah.
Okay, we need to have this to fundamentally improve our economy, because mobility actually supports that, facilitates
100%.
And we have so many innovative companies around Europe that contribute to this.
Yes, yes.
So it's about setting the political agenda. None of us are politicians, but we have to push them a little bit. And
yes.
And I think it has to be addressed and talked about.
Mm-hmm. So push hard, move faster.
Yes.
Yes. And thank you very much for the conversation. I very much enjoyed it.
It was a pleasure. Thank you. Absolutely.
Thanks for listening to Nectar's Conversation Journeys. Subscribe and tune in again next time.